Thanks, Saskia. Well, I've been out of the country for the last 6 months, so it's certainly nice to be back behind the microphone. I wanted to start off by asking how many of you folks are involved in either low-power FM or community radio, just so I get an idea, and how many of you are free radio activists or involved in free radio? So we have a few of you in the room today. It's good to see you. I'm here today to actually tell you about a critical incident that occurred with our station, and it's mostly about our community's response to a threat to a media resource in our community that was highly valued. So I'd like to start off by introducing you briefly to Radio Free Brattleboro. We're an all-volunteer, non-commercial, unlicensed community radio station located in southern Vermont. And we have a mission to broadcast to our community and train its citizens in the art of radio broadcasting. We began broadcasting in July of 1998 in a local teen center, of all places, as a project to help empower local teens and provide wholesome activities to them, keep them off the streets. And that took, as I said, about a year of active citizenry to get that off the ground. And we began with less than a watt of power. You laugh, but it was quite an effort. So after about 5 years of operation, we had relocated our studios twice in order to accommodate our growing projects, and we also gradually increased our broadcast power to about 10 watts, which is large enough to cover the town of Brattleboro. About 13,000 souls live there. And at that point, we had about 75 program hosts who were doing weekly shows, about 50 shows altogether. And during this fifth year of operation, two FCC field agents knocked on our studio door, and they demanded to see our license or our authority to broadcast. And I'm going to ask you to remember that phrase because it becomes quite central to the story later on. They also demanded that we cease and desist broadcasting immediately, which some of you radio free activists out there might have heard before. And it's out of this critical incident that the whole Free RFB, the Free Radio Free Brattleboro campaign, was born. So as an organization, our first step was to engage in a critical analysis of what had happened to us. And we did this in a participatory fashion, engaging our entire staff. And we realized that we had to distill our philosophy, if you will, and be as transparent as possible in order to fight back and assert our rights to the airwaves with the full support of the community. We had always been a public, upfront presence in our town, and by holding open orientation sessions and seeking participation from diverse groups such as school groups, local politicians, senior citizens, people from all walks of life. And now we needed to activate these people, not only the hundreds of people that had come through our studio doors, but also the people that had taken on a more passive role of just listening to our broadcasts and perhaps donating some funds to our station to keep us on the air. So back to distilling our philosophy, we have a pretty simple philosophy, and that's that we believe that every community has the right to broadcast the voices and expressions of its citizens to itself. And we derive this philosophy from the Telecommunications Act of 1934, which declared that the FCC, which basically mandated that the FCC was in charge of regulating and upholding the public commons called the airwaves, this valuable resource that we have in common. And the abandonment of that responsibility by the FCC in order to primarily serve large corporate interests has led RFB to seek regulation and authority from our local community. So in effect, we, the citizens of Brattleboro, are upholding and enforcing the law, stepping in when a federal agency has abandoned their mission to do so. And in this sense, we feel that we are doing what we are obliged to do. That is, assert and exercise our rights to the airwaves, something that we saw that the FCC had failed miserably at. Effectively, this Free RFB campaign was an act of community conscience. And I would say that in retrospect, when considering our methodology for how we engage in this campaign, I really view this methodology as a nonviolent action, and in particular, a nonviolent intervention. And that's my perspective based on my experience with community organizing and my own understanding of nonviolence as a way to affect political and social change. And when I say nonviolent intervention, what I mean is an act that seeks to challenge or to disrupt or to destroy an existing authority. And so what we did was to displace the FCC's existing authority and replace it with community authority. And the major tool of engagement within this methodology was a nonviolent occupation. And in this case, it was a nonviolent occupation of the airwaves. So I'm sort of getting ahead of myself here because I want to take you through the steps of what we did in response to the FCC visit. So first, what we did was we voluntarily complied with the request of the FCC to cease broadcasting in order to assess our situation. We called an all-staff meeting, and we brainstormed options, and we discussed what the options were, and we decided on a course of action. We decided to remain off the air for the time being so that we could focus our energy more fully on the campaign. And so in order to demonstrate our quote-unquote authority to broadcast, RFB would produce documentation in the form of a petition of support from the community, a resolution of support adopted by the town council, and a ballot initiative that would be voted on by the entire community in the following spring. Every spring we have a town meeting style in Vermont. That's how we decide things. We also plan telephone and email campaigns to direct our supporters to request assistance from our political representatives, which later had some unexpected results on a national level, and we can talk about that later. Immediately, however, we issued press releases. We sent them across the region, across the state, to national alternative press, and this sparked dialogue within our community and also generated a lot of press, a lot of interviews for us. And that also helped us to continue to distill our position and our philosophy. And we also were offered legal services locally and through the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Democratic Communications. And at this point, we had realized that the authority to broadcast demanded by the FCC could be documented and proven in a court of law. So what we did was we drafted the petition that asked community members to grant us authority to broadcast. And we saw that being on the streets petitioning and soliciting signatures was inherently educational and allowed us to just interact with our community members and meet people that we hadn't ever met before, our listeners, and get a lot of positive testimony about how Radio Free Brattleboro had affected families, in fact, and changed some lives. And we remained public. We had a great float in the July 4th parade, and we threw a public party for our 6th birthday, and produce these really spiffy t-shirts that I'm sporting right now. And after we had gathered about 3,000 signatures 8 weeks down the road after the initial FCC visit, and many hundreds more from an online petition, we decided that we had enough documentation of our authority to broadcast to return to the airwaves. And as luck would have it, 4 days later, the FCC showed up again, and we had prepared all of our DJs and show hosts with a legal training. And so that since they didn't have a warrant, they weren't allowed in the studios. They were turned away at the door. And then, yeah. And I'm running out of time here, but I'd just like to quickly finish up the story. We just continued our documentation and community education campaign. We held a community forum, including our legal counsel from the National Lawyers Guild. And we had invited local town council members who then passed a resolution supporting our station and asking the FCC urging the FCC to work with us to grant us a license or a waiver for a license. And that, you know, we're from Vermont, and so you might think, oh, that was really easy to get the town council on board. But actually, we had to write the resolution ourselves, and then we had to negotiate the language. And we had the same small-town politics that probably many of you have. And so being from a relatively liberal state didn't really help us out in that situation. And then we began a new petitioning process to qualify for the town ballot. And As we progressed, we continued to send copies of our petitions and our resolutions up the political chain to our state representatives and our national representatives. And we also asked local people, celebrities, movers and shakers, local politicos who were in support of us to write open letters on our behalf, just to continue that dialogue. And we continued nonviolently occupying 107.9 FM, which was actually an unused frequency until such a time as another similarly community-minded organization was issued a low-power FM license and ready to broadcast. And so that was our assertive position. And so nearly 9 months later, the town voted by a 2-to-1 margin in our favor. And this victory basically completed our initial goal of documenting our authority to broadcast. Shortly thereafter, we ended up in federal court, and the FCC had sought an injunction against our station, which means that they could then get a warrant to raid our station and shut us down. But the federal judge was not convinced that shutting us down, well, I should say, this is actually, I need to be really clear about this. The federal judge was not convinced by the FCC that we harmed the federal government enough, so that basically he said that shutting us down would harm the community more. And so we're still in court, but that was quite a victory, and we remain on air to this day. And actually, another happy ending to the story, which is not over yet, is that last month another organization in Brattleboro with similar values to RFB that has pledged to emulate RFB's model in terms of open access and community participation received a construction permit to build. So we have a new light on the horizon. As part of our campaign, the local newspaper was behind us 100%. And one day they ran an editorial saying that our Senator Patrick Leahy, who was a Democrat, was going to receive the First Amendment Award in Washington, D.C. that evening from, I believe it was, the National Group for Television and Radio Broadcasters. I'm not quite sure what the official name of them are. But it was at this huge gala event. And the editorial pointed out, but what has he done for Radio Free Brattleboro? Here we have this really active campaign in our community, and what the heck has he done? So I saw that editorial, and I got a hold of our petition lists and our other lists that we had generated from all of our supporters over the years. And I sent out an email action alert and asked people to call his office and demand accountability from him and say, look, here you are receiving a First Amendment, a free speech award, for God's sakes. But what have you done to support free speech and uphold fair use in our community here in southern Vermont? And so people got on telephone trees and email chains, and I never heard back from the office. And this was nothing new or unusual, but it did have an interesting ripple effect. The folks at Prometheus Radio Project had told us that a couple months down the line, Senator McCain was looking for a co-sponsor for his expansion to the LPFM service. He was trying to put forth legislation to create more low-power FM community radio stations across the country. And he went from door to door, or probably his staff aides went from door to door, looking for a co-sponsor. And when he arrived at Senator Patrick Leahy's office, he said, sure, I'll co-sponsor that. Maybe that'll get those people from Brattleboro off my back.